And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hi.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Hi to all of you. Welcome or welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast, About Time for True Crime.
Oh, guys.
How has your week been? What is new?
Let us know. Email us, send us a DM on the instagram.
Yeah.
Abby and I had a very fun weekend.
We sure did. Well, I got to help throw a bridal shower and Allie got to go to one.
Yay!
It was so much fun. It was so cute.
They did a very wonderful job. I am very into like vintage 40s and 50s pinup style.
Yes.
So everybody came wearing polka dots and pearls and all of that. And it was very nice. They did an amazing job. Shout out to my mom.
It was so
cute. Shout
out
to Abby. Shout out to lots of family.
Yes. Your mom and your mother-in-law did so much. It was so beautiful.
I know.
And they had, okay, you guys, the cutest fucking cupcakes I've ever seen in my life.
Banana split cupcakes.
Yes. The cake was banana. Inside was like the pineapple. And then the frosting was vanilla chocolate strawberry with like literally hot fudge sprinkles and a cherry on top.
And little like walnuts, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
So cute. And I liked them more than I expected because I did not expect myself to go for a banana cake, pineapple filling kind of thing. But mm-hmm. It was really good.
I know.
But that was really fun. We had some cute little backdrops. We did some fun little games. It was good.
We had prizes.
Yes.
I'm so over the moon grateful for the family that really just like got there early, set everything up, and I just had to show up.
Yes, you did. I made her sit in the car. She was like, I'm here. I'm like, oh, that sucks.
Yeah, I call her because my mom was like, don't come in when you get here. And I was like, okay. So I called Abby and I was like, I'm here. She's like, that sucks. I was like, should I go home? What's going on?
Yeah. No, people were probably like, why is this the maid of fucking honor? What is happening right now?
No, it was very nice. But it's so odd, but also great. At weddings that all these different aspects of your life sort of come together at once because
yes.
There's childhood friends, college friends, other friends, and then
family from both sides.
Well, yeah, and then it meets like your family, his family, extended family, family friends, all of these different parts
yes.
of your life kind of all joined together in one room. It is so surreal. It's awesome, but it's like you guys otherwise would have never met, and it's so weird to see all these different like circles of your life
yes
mesh. Interacting with each other.
Also, to anybody who met me at the bridal shower and said they knew me from my voice, oh my gosh, hi, thank you. And also, so scary, wow, I've never
yes.
been recognized by my voice before.
You have
so
big
that
shoes
was something.
To fill.
Oh,
get it.
I just have a lot of shoe. That's all. And it's all filled.
Because you get clown feet.
There's an episode of Broad City where Abby, that's a character. Okay, not me. There's the character Abby borrows a pair of roller skates and she's like, yeah, I probably won't fit in them. And the other friend is like, yeah, it's because his feet are just so big. And she was like, yeah, that's it. And then she's like squeezing her feet in them. And she ends up falling and like hurting herself. And she was like, it's probably because these shoes are just so big.
And she's like, trying to get them on.
And Abby was like, yeah, they're actually kind of tight. And the friend is like, yeah, I know. I was trying to make you feel better. That's me. And you and your little Polly Pocket fucking shoes because you're 2 feet tall.
I know. I am a solid 6, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty, probably
you
in
just
reality too, but
also that.
Also the
no.
the size like the
16.
Shoe size is yeah the shoe size is pretty universal for me, so that's like the one thing that I can order from anywhere and like universally I am usually correct.
Is
that's
that in kids
good.
Too?
Go fuck yourself. Yeah. yes, it is. My light up Skechers.
Thanks, because I'm a size 10 even at the clown store. So
I love it. Well, we have a lot to get into today, so I want to jump into it.
Okay.
I have to say that if you thought last week's episode was bad, this one I think is worse. Not because the crimes are worse, because they're as bad as they're going to get. It's just that I think we know more about them, so we're offered more details than we would have had.
Oh.
So, for example, when Frances McDonald was killed, there wasn't, I mean, they could put together what they believed happened from his body, but there was no letter.
Okay.
And we're going to talk about letters here.
Okay.
Which are very descriptive. So we're going to get to all of that in a little bit. I know I was listening to our episode last week and there was a lot of things I said, but we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about that. A lot of the we're going to talk abouts are happening in this episode and in next episode. So
okay,
it is, I've got it down to three parts. They're going to be longer parts, but okay. I just, again, I thought that four episodes or more would have been too long to live in this.
Yes.
So I think we're sitting pretty at three. We're going to cover everything that I think is the most important.
Okay.
And if you have any other things that you're interested in, I'm still going to point everyone in the direction of the deranged book that we talked about. The sources are all the same for all of the episodes.
Yep. And they are all going to be linked in that Google Doc. So you just click on sources and it'll pop right up.
Perfect. So, okay. Skippers, stop skipping.
Yoo-hoo, pod's on.
Welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast.
Oh, thank you.
And also welcome to part two of our series on Albert Fish. If you didn't hear part one, I'd definitely recommend you do so before tuning in here because you might be a little bit lost. If not, or not, you do you, babe. We're here for you no matter what.
What a wild ride to jump into, though.
I know. Last week's episode was a doozy, and I'd be lying if I said it was going to get better from here. Truthfully, okay. I do think it's going to get worse. So hold on to your butts, and please keep your hands, arms, feet, and legs inside the podcast at all times, because it is going to be one of the bumpiest rides we've ever had.
Yay.
When I left you last, we covered Fish's first confirmed murder, that of 8-year-old Frances McDonald.
Ugh.
And we ended with the disappearance of 4-year-old Billy Gaffney. He and another child, 3-year-old Bill Beaton, were playing in the hallways of their tenement building when they seemingly disappeared. Mr. Beaton and the neighbor boy, Johnny, found Bill, but there was no sign of Billy. And when they asked Bill what happened to him and what happened to Billy Gaffney, he said the boogeyman took him.
Ugh.
And he is absolutely right. Police were notified immediately when Billy wasn't found, and initially there were two theories. The first was that he was kidnapped for ransom.
Okay.
In the 20s, many of the communities were poor, and abducting children for ransom was shockingly common.
Oh.
But the Gaffneys lived in a poor neighborhood, in a poor tenement building, and they didn't have money.
Right.
You can't get blood from a stone, and you can't squeeze money from people who don't have it. The Gaffneys weren't a family you'd get a large ransom payout from like you might if you grabbed a kid from a different part of town.
Okay.
It's horrible, it's awful, but it's true. And it did used to happen. These were very dark days. The other theory was that he wandered off. He was four, inquisitive, and maybe bored playing up and down the hallways every day. They thought he might have wandered out of the building. There was a canal, the Gowanus Canal, not far, and they thought he might have fallen in there and drowned.
Okay.
But as days passed, these theories became less and less likely because a credible, believable ransom note didn't show up.
Right.
Plenty of other letters did, more on that in a minute, but nothing that they really thought held weight. And they also searched that body of water and didn't find him. So while that was great that they didn't find his body,
they also hadn't found him.
They hadn't had any, they didn't find anything. They didn't right. find any leads. They didn't find any hints. They have what a 3-year-old told them, which is that the boogeyman took him.
Right. Which, as you and I know, is true and terrifying, but as far as they know, is not helpful in the slightest.
Of course.
Not for an investigation.
They searched empty buildings like warehouses and other industrial buildings, residential buildings, anywhere he might have wandered off to, but still, they didn't find him.
Ugh.
Volunteers in the hundreds showed up to assist in the search.
Wow.
Hundreds of police officers, too. And again, the damn Boy Scouts is like, let them tie knots and not look for bodies. They are not bloodhounds.
Yes. The Boy Scouts should be learning about their little platform tents, okay?
None of this. Interviews with 3-year-old Bill Beaton revealed that he described the boogeyman as a thin older man with gray hair and a gray mustache. I'm sure that he didn't have that that eloquent of speech at 3 years old, but
right
when they were, they probably did a sketch or something, and he was like, Noah, that was gray, this was here, you know.
Right.
But again, he was three.
Three.
Damn near impossible to solve a case with the testimony of a toddler. And because Frances McDonald's murder happened in Staten Island and Billy Gaffney disappeared in Brooklyn, the creepy, frail, gray man with the gray mustache detail wasn't linked between the two.
Right.
Then there were the letters. And I'm not even talking about Fish's letter yet. The Gaffney family received letters that so many victim families get from the underbelly of society. What today are DMs and comments from accounts with no profile pictures, the equivalent were writing these letters.
Ugh.
The Gaffneys received letters from sick, twisted people who claimed to have Billy. Some who claimed to have already killed him. One claimed his body was in an abandoned building and gave an address. And when that address was searched, it either didn't exist or he wasn't there.
Ugh.
Another claimed they were coming back for the beaten boy, so Billy wouldn't be lonely anymore.
That's so fucked.
So, I mean, it had gotten out that he was with three-year-old Bill Beaton, and once that's printed, hell, people are going to run with it. And so now there's threats toward the Beaton family as well. Sighting reports came in, and each time the dread crashed back down when it just wasn't him.
Ugh.
Worse yet, each and every one of these claims had to be investigated, even if they knew it couldn't be true, because what if it was?
Right.
Not only did these letters torment the already suffering Gaffney family, it depleted finite resources and sent them in 100 different directions, and all the while, the gray man, the boogeyman, was still out there.
Yeah. Oh, I hate that.
Billy's mom, Mrs. Gaffney, breaks my heart. Her four-year-old baby was stolen from her. And every time that there was hope, she held on to it, only for it to be ripped away.
Ugh.
She physically and emotionally suffered. She stopped eating, stopped sleeping. She was admitted to the hospital for chest pains. She had a tear duct infection because of how many tears she cried.
Oh my gosh.
But she couldn't give up hope and had to believe that there was still a chance that she'd find her baby. That he was out there, alive. She kept his bedroom as he'd left it. She set a plate for him at dinner. Because not doing so would mean accepting that he's gone. And she couldn't do that. A new detail came out in the investigation, though, when a man named Anthony Barone came forward.
Okay, Anthony.
He was a train conductor, and he recalled seeing a frail, grayish-looking man with sunken eyes and a gray mustache who looked like a goblin. My words, not his. He moved his freakish hands all freaky-like, and he remembered that too. He saw a toddler with him who the man gave crackers and candy. The toddler fit the description of Billy, and Anthony said that the boy cried the whole time.
Oh.
And on the way out, the man with him asked for directions to a ferry to Staten Island. Staten Island is where Frances McDonald was taken.
Right.
Anthony thought it odd, but quickly went about his day until he read later that there was a missing toddler that looked just like the boy he saw. Another train conductor who was there confirmed Barone's recollection of the events. Later, Anthony Barone quit his job as a train conductor and joined the police force because this case got to him so much.
Wow.
Albert Fish later confirmed that he was the man on the train.
Oh my gosh.
A New York Times article dated back from 1928 wrote of a sighting of a boy they believed to be Billy in Montana.
Okay.
He was accompanied by a couple that looked as if they could be his parents and a pharmacist who was called a druggist in the paper, noticed the boy spoke with an accent and he thought he must be from the Northeast.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And he called it in. Mr. Gaffney traveled from New York to Montana to see the boy with his own eyes, holding on to hope that this could be his kid.
Oh my gosh.
But he met that boy and he said, no, that's not my Billy.
How heartbreaking.
In reality, that boy had been adopted from New York, so the druggist was right on it.
Wow.
The kid talked funny to him and he called it in because this case had reached so far.
You said, I saw something, I said something.
Yeah, and this one didn't end in the murder of a man.
Amazing.
Yeah, so there's that. And he was right. This kid did look similar to Billy, too, but it wasn't him. His dad knew that. Ultimately, Billy Gaffney's body was never found. And because of this, not only did his family never receive the closure that they deserved, investigators also couldn't accurately determine how and when Billy died. Albert Fish liked to write. We've talked about this in the last episode, and his writings were not flowery or optimistic or sweet. He wrote some of the most fucked up shit you've ever heard in your life.
Yeah.
I don't think there's another way to describe it that captures just how devoid of humanity his letters are. But he sent vile letters to women looking for tenants in his past. He sent them to those looking for suitors. And then he turned his focus on the families of his victims. I will not be reading the letters in their entirety. It's hard enough to read them to myself, and I won't be doing that to you.
Ugh.
The letter written to the Gaffney family by Albert Fish was something out of a nightmare, and I don't recommend you look it up. And I'm not teasing you. I'm not dangling this in front of your face to say, don't do it. I'm saying, seriously, don't do it.
Yeah.
I strongly discourage you from it. And if you choose to, proceed with caution. In this letter, Albert Fish claims to have tortured and assaulted Billy before killing him. He wrote of how he dismembered him and disposed of his remains in a mucky body of water. And while I think he's capable of what he wrote, I think it's possible it isn't true.
I hope not.
Albert Fish wrote these things to mess with the reader. That's right. Part of how he got off on it was that you would read something so horrible and that you weren't expecting to.
Right.
He wasn't going for consenting adults who wanted to write these letters back and forth. And
no, he wasn't looking for a pen pal.
No. Parts of this letter might have been true, but it was part of a game and the enjoyment for him. He liked putting it on paper. He liked that somebody had to read the despicable things that he wrote. I sincerely hope none of it's true, and I can only hold on to the little shred of light that just maybe it isn't. The aftermath of Billy Gaffney's disappearance in Brooklyn wasn't unlike that of Francis McDonald's in Staten Island in that the community was understandably enraged, but misplaced the direction of that rage.
Ugh.
After the description of the ghoulish older man walking with Billy was released in the papers, every older gentleman was getting the side eye. Elderly grandparents, neighbors, men on their way to work were attacked for merely resembling the gray man. These are more victims. They are ever-reaching in this case. Tens, if not hundreds, of people were harmed directly and indirectly by the actions of Albert Fish. And when you really step back and consider it, it's staggering.
Yes.
While the communities were aching to solve the case, Albert Fish struck again.
Okay.
This is the murder Albert Fish is synonymous with. And if you've heard of him, it's likely related to this. This is the murder of Grace Budd.
Oh.
And the Grace Budd letter is one of the most horrific things I think I've ever read. The only thing I can hold on to is that I hope that it's not true and that it was an attempt to mess with the reader. The intended reader being her family.
Right.
In 1928, an 18-year-old named Edward Budd put in an ad in the New York Daily Paper looking for work.
Okay.
He was a city kid who was eager to work. He wanted money to be able to help support his family, but he also wanted fresh air and to learn. He was young and able, and he was willing to do the hard, laborious work that maybe others weren't.
Right.
But as a city kid, he kind of wanted to get out of the city.
Yeah.
While it sounds odd to us today, very odd, this was commonplace, to put these ads in the paper. There wasn't Indeed or Facebook to connect on or Glassdoor. You put ads in the paper, or you heard of an opportunity from somebody else.
Right.
The Budd family wasn't wealthy, not even close. And their 18-year-old son, Edward, wanted to learn and work and help out. because his family didn't have money.
Right.
His ad said, quote, young man, 18, wishes position in country. Edward Budd, 406 West 15th Street.
Okay.
This ad ran May 27th, 1928. I know, the full name, address, red flags.
Yeah.
Not something we would do today. Would definitely not recommend it. But they didn't know then what we know now. And this is how you found work.
Right.
Edward Budd was, in fact, 18. So he wasn't lying about that. And was the son of Albert and Delia Budd.
Okay.
Because Albert Budd is also Albert, I'm going to refer to him as Mr. Budd. So okay. That we don't get confused with Albert and Albert here.
Got it.
There's lots of Alberts like sprinkled throughout this here.
It's really a name of the era, it seems.
Yes. So again, I'm going to just say Albert Fish, Albert or Fish, and then Mr. Budd.
Okay.
The Budds had 5 children, 3 boys, Edward, George, and Albert Jr., mm-hmm. and 2 girls, Beatrice and Grace. Mr. Okay. Budd worked in insurance, but times were tough. The Great Depression was 1929 into the 30s, and we're in 1928 right now.
Got it.
So this wasn't a booming economy by any means.
No, we weren't at the Great Depression, but we were still in a good depression.
Yeah, we were.
Yeah.
We were like Great Depression lowercase g.
Oh, yeah. We're at a lowercase gd.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So while it was great that Mr. Budd did have work, because that wasn't all that common at that time, right. and where they were living, but that work wasn't supporting a house of 7.
Yeah.
And feeding 7 people and keeping a roof over the heads of 7 people and the day-to-day things for 7 people. That's a lot. Edward Budd, his son, was just looking for work to help out. I mean, I'm sure to have a little bit of his own freedom.
Right.
But just the concept of putting your full name, your address, this is where I live, this is what I want to do, I'm this age.
Right.
You know, any other information, oh, I'm home alone. It's just, it's odd. But then you think about all of the information that we publicize.
Yeah.
Even though we're not putting it in a paper, you might put it in a Facebook post.
Right.
This is where I go to school. This is what I'm studying. These are the hours. This is where I work.
I'm on vacation.
Either my house is empty or someone who doesn't live in my house is staying in my house temporarily. You know, we talk about where our kids go to school, what teams they're on, their team schedule, when their games are.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when we think of the considerable amount of information that we offer up for free.
It's constantly growing, and it's so much if you put it together.
I mean, I've done some deep dives on people, and it's kind of creepy how much you can find out. And I do not consider myself a web sleuth by any means, but you just, this one's friendless, here to here to here. I mean, come on, ladies.
Yeah.
We've done it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. The
FBI should hire me. My FBI guy is like, damn, girl, you.
Yeah, my FBI guy's like, how'd you get there?
I can't even do that.
Right. And I'm like, really? Because she was dating this guy at this time and then she deleted all of the photos. But right before then, she started posting this guy. So I think there was an over. Like, you know what I mean?
And his Instagram handle used to be this. But now when you click it, it says no users. But it's still there because she put it in a comment and she didn't delete that. And it did.
Yeah.
And like, that's how psychotic we can be.
And it's
lovingly, endearingly,
easy enough to do if you've grown up with the internet at all.
And so while we can do that, and maybe we did that in high school, or we were trying to find out about a job and we're creeping on people that work there to find out if they post about how bad it is to work there, you know,
yes.
All of these different things that could be well-intended or just for fun or petty or whatever. They're not dangerous. They're not harmful in that way. But
right.
Didn't mean that people don't partake in that. But if you and I can do that, think of who else can.
Oh, yeah.
And in this time, while there's no Facebook and posts or LinkedIn that tells every job you've ever held ever in your life ever, there were the papers, and this is where you looked for work. There were want ads. This is where you would post this, and he did.
Yeah.
And it's here that the Budd family's path crossed with Albert Fish's.
Oh, I don't want it to cross with his.
You don't. That ad ran May 27th.
Mm-hmm.
On May 28th, there was a knock at the door. None other than Albert Fish had shown up to their home.
Huh?
But he introduced himself as Frank Howard.
Oh, Frank.
So we're switching.
Okay.
Frank Howard. And this Frank Howard man inquired about Edward's ad.
Oh.
He appeared well-dressed, friendly. He said that he owned a farm, but his wife had recently abandoned him and his six kids. And finding good help was hard, and he was looking forward to speaking with Edward about this opportunity. And maybe, in a way, this was appealing to them, because...
Yeah.
Well, he's got six children, we've got five kids, you know, maybe the adults could relate to that in some way, you know, he's just a single dad trying to make it work. Now, granted, he's a lot more wealthy than them, he comes in pretty well-dressed, decent suit.
Ugh.
Sounds like he's got some business opportunities, but, like, you know, it's really hard to find people that are willing to put in the hard work. Working on a farm isn't easy. We've got chickens. We've got this. We've got that. I really need some strong, able-bodied people to come out here and help me out, and I'm willing to pay you pretty decently. And yeah. In this economy, pretty decently is fucking amazing.
Decent enough, yeah.
He had this uncanny ability to turn off the freakish, ghoulish walk that he had, and the freaky hands and the goblin look. And he could be normal. Or at least he appeared normal and professional, yeah. Even likable.
I mean, he got married, so he has enough of a face that he can put on, you know?
Oh, yeah.
As
they spoke, the job sounded great. Lots of animals. Lots of work to go around, great pay. When can you start? Edward was ready to go. And Frank Howard, said, I'll come back for you this weekend. In fact, the job sounded so good, one of Edward's friends asked if he could also go to work for him. And Frank Howard said, absolutely. You get a job and you get a job. And if everybody looks under their chairs, you get a job.
And if it's too good to be true,
it is.
It usually is.
So Frank Howard left, and he assured them that he would be back on Saturday to pick up Edward and his friend. I think the friend was Will or Willie. And from there, the three of them would head off to the farm in Long Island. Albert Fish fully intended to murder Edward Budd. And it seems as a bonus, he was getting one of his friends.
Yeah.
The Budds were over the moon. A well-paying job in that economy, getting out of the city, breathing fresh air, and learning skilled work.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah.
They were happy for their son. They were happy that he had a friend going with them. They were happy that they would get some financial help because he was going to throw a few bucks back to try to, you know, give them a hand. When he was home, he was going to go home to them.
Right.
But he could go work the summer or go work. I mean, as long as he was allowed, as long as he could, as long as there was work to be had, Edward was game.
Yeah.
On Saturday, June 2nd, Fish sent a messenger with a handwritten note to the Budd family saying, unfortunately, he couldn't make it Saturday, but he would be there Sunday.
Okay.
This is important. Remember, handwritten note, can't come Saturday, will be there Sunday.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Now, I don't know what actually came up. I don't know the excuse that he gave him or gave the Budd family when he did see them on Sunday, because he did arrive. But I just wonder if this friend of Edward's kind of tagging along, Frank Howard, wasn't expecting that. And right. So in the moment, while he's like, you get a job and you get a job, he's like, fuck, I wanted to kill Edward. Now I'm going to have this other person here.
Right.
So I do wonder if this is why he delayed it a day, like if he had to make other arrangements because he now needed to accommodate how the hell he was going to kill somebody else.
Right. Figure out a new plan.
We don't end up finding the answer to that. That's just my speculation.
Okay.
Regardless, though, on Sunday, Frank Howard arrived again, and he looked very dapper, clean, and he was friendly.
Okay.
A guest never arrives empty-handed. He brought strawberries and assorted cheeses and claimed they came from his farm.
Oh.
What he'd really done was stop at a store along the way and purchase them, but
yeah,
the Budd family didn't know that.
Who's gonna tell him?
On his way, he also left a package with the shopkeeper and asked if he could come back later to retrieve it.
Okay.
And the shopkeeper said that was fine, and so there he left it. The Budds welcomed him in. He was sweet-talking them. They shared some laughs. Frank Howard asked if Edward had kept that note he sent.
Yeah. It's a weird question.
And Mr. Bunn said, yeah, it's over there. And I think he pointed to a shelf or something. And in the middle of the conversation, Albert Fish got up, grabbed that note, and buried it in his pocket while continuing the conversation.
Weird.
Like in a swift movement, grabbed that, put it in, continued talking. So it was like he had to get up and cross to the other side of the room to get it,
yeah,
hide it, and go. And Mr. Budd thought this was odd.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that odd. Because everything else about this guy sounded great.
Right. Not odd enough that you're going to be like, never mind, fuck your good paying job and your benefits.
Right. And his son's an adult.
Right.
But they didn't want to do anything to mess up this opportunity for him.
Right.
You don't want to insult the man.
No.
What Albert Fish was really doing was removing any evidence of himself.
Yeah.
He had lunch with them. He ate lunch with the people he intended to harm. He intended to take their son away from them and kill him and likely eat him, torture him. But he dined as if he really were just a farm owner who needed help. Now, Albert Fish preferred either children or men that looked like children. So very young looking men,
great,
very young outwardly appearing men. And even though he was 18, Edward Budd was rugged. He was muscular and could not only probably throw Albert Fish on the ground in a fight, but he didn't look young either.
Mm.
So, you know how there's a young looking 18 and then there's those 18-year-olds that look 30?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying he looked 30, but he definitely didn't look like an 18-year-old that could pass as 14.
Got it.
But Albert Fish figured, fuck it. Okay, he'll do it. I guess he intended to make it work. And as they're sitting and they're eating their cheese and their strawberries and they're shooting the shit and having a good conversation and nobody really wants to, you know, upset him. I mean, he's not that he's doing anything worth upsetting him over, but it's going really well.
Right.
He's a friendly guy. The parents are getting to know their son's employer.
Yeah.
And then Grace Budd walked in.
No.
And everything changed. Grace, who loved ones called Gracie, arrived home after playing with friends. She was still in her church clothes. She wore a white dress, tights, white shoes, and costume pearls, which were her favorite. Me too, girl. She met the man introduced to her as Frank Howard.
Okay.
He told her that she reminded him of his own granddaughter. He asked about school, and in a sick way, he had this ability to connect with the children, too. He disarmed them as much as their parents. She sat on his lap. She spent time with him while he was over. He gave her a stack of bills, like a stack of cash, and asked if she was a good counter. She totaled all the money up. He had about $92. That's about $1,700 today.
Great.
The Budds were blown away at the amount of cash he had on him in that economy.
Right.
And they, again, were very poor. I'm not saying that's the most amount of money they'd ever seen. I don't mean right, that, but...
But this was his pocket change?
This was his walking around money.
Yeah.
And when Grace got it right, he rewarded her with some coins and said to go buy candy for her and her sister.
Oh.
So she and Beatrice ran off to the store. Albert Fish decided Edward Budd was no longer his target. It was Grace.
Okay.
He could adjust on a dime. Because remember, he was only there to pick up Edward and that friend Will. And they were to be on their way. But this didn't happen. He saw Grace and everything changed and he was quick with it.
Okay.
He said, you know, boys, I'm going to have to come back and get you in a little bit. And he said to the family, he said, it's my niece's birthday and I'm expected at the party. He said it wasn't exactly planned, but his sister had sent word to him of this party that he was having last night, or that she was having for okay. her for her daughter. And said, you know, I just found out about it last night. He said, that's why I'm wearing the suit.
Okay.
I mean, what does a farmer need to wear the suit for, right? So he's dressed up to go to his niece's birthday party. And he said, you know, she actually just turned 10. I think she and Grace would get along really well. There's going to be fun things at the party for children to do there. So why don't I bring Grace with me? She can play at the party, have some fun. When I get back, I'll drop her off. I'll pick up the boys and we can go.
Fucking guy.
Delia and Albert Budd were initially hesitant, especially Delia.
Right.
But they were kind of in an odd predicament because they found him nice, respectable, and he's now their son's employer.
Right.
If they said no, they feared that they would risk offending him. After all, their son was about to leave with him in a few hours, so if one of their kids can go with him, why can't their other kid go? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The difference being it's an 18-year-old man versus a 10-year-old girl.
Yeah.
Ultimately, they agreed because they wanted Grace to have a fun time, and it seemed there weren't really many opportunities for that.
Yeah, not in those days, era, time.
Mr. Budd said to his wife, let the poor kid go. She don't see much good times.
And how do you say no to that as a parent? Because not only is there that cognitive dissonance, right? Like, we're letting our other kid go. So either I'm wrong and he's safe, or I'm a hypocrite and I'm letting my other kid go.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have like, okay, this man who's offering such a nice job, who clearly has money, right? He shows up wearing a suit. He's got a lot of pocket change. Clearly he has all of this and he wants to show another one of our kids a good time at a place with other kids, allegedly.
Where there's fun things to do. And right. They're like, Grace doesn't get to do that ever.
Right.
Let the kid have a fun Sunday.
Ugh.
Fish apologized for the inconvenience and gave Edward Budd and his friend Will $2 each to go see a movie while they waited for him.
Oh.
He gave the Budd family his sister's address, 137th and Columbus Ave, and said he'd have her home by 9 p.m.
Wow, a proper date.
Ugh.
Disgusting.
Delia Budd stood outside and waved to her daughter as she walked away with Frank Howard.
Okay.
She would never see her again.
Yeah.
Grace was not home by 9 p.m., like you might have imagined. And the next morning, panic really hit.
Okay.
Edward Budd, Grace's brother, the 18-year-old, was sent down to the police station to report his sister missing. They went to the address that he gave for the supposed party, but the address didn't exist at all.
Yep.
There wasn't a house there. It was fake. There was no farm in Farmingdale, Long Island. I don't know if that's a place, but a farm in Farmingdale.
Certainly not.
It's on the nose. And there was no Frank Howard.
Yeah.
The investigation into Grace Budd's disappearance began immediately.
Good.
When Grace left with Fish, they passed a small group of Grace's friends and she waved to them. They all said they saw her and an older man that they didn't know get into a car, like the car had been waiting for them. This gave credit to the accomplice theory, to me at least. It holds weight, because why was there a car waiting? Now, could he have, I guess, sent for a car? Maybe, but where along the way would he have done that? Why would the car wait there for them?
Right.
It did just kind of seem like he was waiting for a ride, but maybe the kids didn't notice him, like, stop a taxi or something. I'm not really sure what transport looked like back then, but they did say that they got into a car.
Okay.
And that was the last that the friends saw Grace. Unfortunately, the Budd family got the same types of evil anonymous letters that claimed to have her, claimed she was alive, claimed they'd already killed her. The poor family. She disappeared. I mean, they never heard from her again. They never saw her. She was just gone. And to make it worse, all of these letters were brutal.
Oh.
But they also led the investigation in all different directions, just like with Billy Gaffney.
Right.
It led them to nothing, but they had X amount of resources, and all of these letters, they had to try to investigate until they found who wrote them, and investigate till they found who wrote it, or try to see if there was any truth or lies in there. What could they rule out? Because if you get 10 letters, well, okay, odds are 9 of them are fake. I mean, odds are 10 of them are fake, but
right,
even if 9 of them are, one could be real.
And you have to be able to count each one out as not real.
Yes.
And so it might lead you to nothing, but part of the problem is when it's a whole lot of nothing.
Exactly.
Because you have to, really, to do your due diligence to find out. Ugh. Oh, I hate this.
As for Albert Fish, he was admitted to Bellevue Hospital for psychiatric treatment on 2 separate occasions.
Okay.
And he was also arrested for sending those vile letters to unsuspecting people. He wrote, I think, just like really inappropriate things to, again, these like women looking for love and like looking for dates or companionship or anything.
Yeah.
Or tenants or anything else like that. And it just makes you wonder how accurate of a historian he was, how much was for kicks and the reaction, and how much was true. And potentially, right, was there anything he believed was true but wasn't? Because he told doctors that he'd been drawn to writing these kinds of letters since he and some coworkers found a stack of dirty letters on a painting job.
Okay.
Since then, he wanted to write them too, but to people who weren't expecting them, those who didn't consent, who weren't game for naughty letter writing. And yeah, I think we talked about that last episode.
So people who shouldn't be receiving them because it's not between 2 or more consensual adults.
Correct. Yes. Because when he found them with his buddies, I mean, I'm saying buddies, I don't know that the man had friends, but his colleagues.
Sure.
They were reading them out loud, like joking, finding it funny, but that was like, whoa, he had never thought of that before. And then that continued the rest of his life. He was a younger man when he found those letters, and now,
no turning back, I guess. Although he could, he just chose not to.
He did. While he was hospitalized, he was considered polite, quiet, cooperative.
Of course.
Probably because there were no children there to victimize.
Yeah, it's the easiest time to be polite and cooperative and a good person is when your victim type isn't right in front of you.
He appeared normal, even. As normal as I think he could be. But they did say that he suffered from sexual psychopathy.
Okay.
Which is quite the diagnosis, and I'm not quite sure how they figured that out, but they attributed his letter writing to his age and said that while he was overall carrying on well, his mind might be starting to go a little bit, and these letters were a result of a man going senile. Basically, he's a dirty old man, and that's just what happens. It's the circle of life. You were once a man, and then you morph into a vile, predatory, icky, funny, goblin-looking shitbag, douchebag, scroat, and you write letters like that, and then you die. Oh.
Well, I didn't know there was that extra step in the circle of life, but I guess it's good to prepare myself now.
I hadn't heard it, but I'm glad they got to the bottom of it. He was released from the hospital. They didn't have anything to hold him on. And again, pretty model patient. Meanwhile, for the investigators, the crude letters the Budd family received from anonymous writers led them to other theories and suspects, ones away from Albert Fish.
Okay.
They also started hearing from the public.
Okay.
For example, they got another report that they considered related. A woman came forward to say that her son was almost abducted. And the dates happened to be, like, just days before Grace Budd's disappearance.
Okay.
So it kind of, like, the way that it lined up was, like, her son could have been, like, an abduction attempt that failed, and then Grace was found, and that's when Grace got abducted.
Okay.
She said she was making dinner while her son was playing outside, which just seems to be this, like, common theme of, like, the mom is busy tending to other children and the food, and the man, if lucky enough to work, is like out at work, out straight all day. And so she's trying to keep an eye on all these kids. Anyway, she said she was cooking when out of the corner of her eye, she saw three people leading her son away.
Oh.
And one of them was carrying the bike that he was riding.
Ugh.
So she ran out of the house. She ran after them. She said it was an older gentleman with a gray mustache.
Yep.
An older woman and a young adult man.
Hmm.
They said they were going to buy a bell for him for his bike. But it was a Sunday and every shop was closed back then. Like yeah. when things were closed on Sundays. So that was a lie, because where the hell were you going to go get that?
Yeah.
And why would you find my child and decide that you're going to buy him a bell for his bike?
You can. Most people at the time could barely afford dinner.
And why did you need to bring him with you? You know, all of these things, it was like, don't lead a child away from their home without their parents' consent. And they didn't have it. So she kind of like pushed them. She was like, what the fuck are you talking about? If this wasn't Albert Fish, who the hell was that?
Right.
But even if it was, who was the woman? Who was the younger guy?
And why? What's going on?
What? And if this isn't him, okay, still, who's that old man?
Right.
Whose man's is that? Who's trying to walk away with kids? Who's like, it really does seem like it's possible. There was this whole network of people preying on children.
Yeah.
That just blended in.
Oh, that makes me so angry.
And kids were popping up dead. Like, these children weren't the only ones killed, but these were the most vicious, notorious ones. But right. it wasn't like Grace Budd was the only kid from her town that was killed at that time. I mean, unfortunately, this happened a lot. The search into these murders, all three of them, stirred up a lot of dirt that needed to be sifted. And in the process, some criminals were brought to justice, even though they weren't related to these cases. So if we're looking for the smallest shred of silver lining, I would say at least justice was served in some cases in efforts to serve justice in these ones.
Okay.
Months passed. Nothing. And then there was a tip.
Okay.
Detective King took the lead on Grace's case and dedicated so many hours of his life to find the person or people responsible. He was an incredible asset in this case. He poured himself into this. And before we end this episode, I will tell you how he connected the clues to Albert Fish. But before that, there's years of other theories, suspects, investigations, dead ends, and frustration.
Okay.
Police were tipped off to a man named, you guessed it, Albert.
Mm-hmm.
Albert Courthill, to be exact.
Okay.
This man was a con artist, and he often utilized little girls in his cons by offering them money to rip people off. Okay. So they might pretend to be his daughter or another family member or what have you, but these girls would go off with him and then they'd come back.
Okay.
He wasn't abusing them, he was using them.
Right.
And I don't, whether consenting or not, I'm not exactly sure, but this was a theory that they kind of kicked around because maybe Grace was alive. Maybe she was just used in a con. Maybe she looked like this man and could pass as his kid.
And for lack of a better term of what it is, but maybe it's like she's just being trafficked in a work sense of like, here, kid, now you're with us and you're working for us.
Right. Like, that would make sense because she's not useful to them dead if that's the case.
Right.
So, okay, there's hope here that she could be alive. She's just forced to work. I mean, I'm sure the conditions aren't good. I'm sure whatever. But
it's something. And it's a silver lining they could hope about.
Yes. The Buds were shown a photo of Albert Courthill. And while Edward and Mr. Budd didn't think he was the man that sat with them, Delia Budd, the mother, did.
Oh.
So not only do we have this like sketchy con artist history utilizing children, we also have the mother of the missing child positively identifying him.
Right.
And they're looking for this guy now. Remember, though, to them, Albert Fish is Frank Howard. So it's not that they were looking for men named Albert. This one just happened to be named Albert. They just didn't have a reason to think otherwise. They just couldn't find Frank Howard.
Right.
The irony of this man being named Albert was lost on them.
Mm.
In the midst of searching for this Albert Courthill, they found all of his aliases, one of those being Charles Howard. So Frank Howard, Charles Howard, Albert. Okay. Anyway, the irony just gets thicker. I know. A woman, a Mrs. Howard, called into the police to say that her husband, Charles Howard, stole from her, and he looks like the guy that could have been Grace Budd's kidnapper.
Okay.
So they find the guy, but he's not Albert Courthill, aka Charles Howard. He's just Charles Howard.
Right.
A different scammer. So now we've got two men here. Albert Courthill, my gosh, who went by Charles Howard sometimes, and then a real Charles Howard, who also scammed his wife. And he actually was brought up on charges for this scam. Like, he stole money from his wife.
Okay.
But by now, Delia Budd had now identified Charles Howard as Frank Howard.
Okay.
But his alibi was proven, and he wasn't their guy. So she is just positively identifying every man they show her, essentially, which is awful. She's so desperate. She just wants her baby back.
Right.
But I think she could have even possibly altered her own memory and truly believed each one of them was the guy.
Well, yeah.
But all she did was ruin her own credibility so that if she ever really did see the guy, she's no longer believable. She says yes to everything. She's
not a credible witness anymore. Exactly.
In September of 1930, 2 years later. Ooh. 2 years. Imagine, put yourself in Grace Budd's family's shoes. 2 years have gone by. She walked away with a man to go to a party, and she never came home. They never saw him again. He didn't come back for the boys. Nothing happened.
Oh, I hate it. She's what, 10?
Yes.
So now she's been gone a fifth of the time that you had with her.
Yep, so she'd nothing be 12 has happened. Now.
You don't know, and don't get me wrong, like, I know 10 to 12 isn't the biggest age jump in terms of, like, physical characteristics, but she's not going to look like 10-year-old her anymore.
No, and if she's been put to work or, God forbid, trafficked in other ways or something, she probably looks very different.
Right.
Potentially even older than 12.
Yeah.
If not by design, then, she's just grown into, like, starting to resemble a young woman.
Yes,
but you wouldn't know that because you saw her when she was 10 last
in a church outfit after playing with her friends.
Yeah,
so you're like, oh, my sweet baby, my happy angel. Like, not okay, this child who is living a life of hardship and stress, if she's alive at all, which, I mean, talking about it on this podcast, you and I know what that means, but like, just sitting in her family's shoes, it had to be so devastating, because now not only are you losing your child, but also this hope and dream of some good job for your son is gone too.
And not only that, but I can't imagine what went through their minds, because they let their 10-year-old daughter walk away with this man, but at the same time, you were just about to let your 18-year-old, I mean, I say let, he's an adult, but
yeah,
you were encouraging and facilitating and entertaining this man so that your 18-year-old son could go off with this man. So
right.
It's heartbreaking to think that it was like either way they were going to lose a child just because Frank Howard happened to introduce himself.
Right.
Albert Fish, aka Frank Howard.
Right.
You know, but it was like he walked in there intending to deprive them of one of their children.
Right.
He just ended up with a different one. One that was more, for lack of a better way of putting it, his type.
Also more vulnerable.
And easier to control.
Yep.
Edward Budd was 18 and like a jacked guy. I really don't know how this frail, decaying scroat was anticipating on overpowering Edward Budd, which to me, or his friend for that matter, including right. his friend. So that also adds to the potential accomplice theory, I suppose. But I can't imagine Frank Howard / Albert Fish taking on an 18-year-old like strong boy, because he had gone after like developmentally challenged men right. before. And even then, he was able to lure them where he could tie them up. And then he tortured them. But, like, he wasn't
holding them down himself and but, inflicting pain.
But when he was doing that, my understanding was that he was approaching them as him. He was Albert Fish. So he wasn't pretending to have a farm and a place to go and all of these things, where at some point Edward Budd would probably have been like, where the hell is the farm?
Right.
You know, I'm getting out of here. Versus Thomas Kedden that we talked about before was in a, I don't believe, consenting relationship with Albert, but it wouldn't have been uncommon for him to have been alone with him.
Right.
You know, or brought to a place for them to do what they wanted to do. Obviously, Albert wasn't going to bring his victims to his home.
Right.
So, I don't know. I don't know if that makes sense, but I imagine that it's very different if you're posing as Frank Howard and you're like, we're going to my farm, and then I bring you to a place that is definitely not in the direction of the place I told you we were going, mm-hmm. and it's not a farm. At some point, the 18-year-old's going to say, this is fucking creepy, I'm leaving.
Yeah, well, but that's also if he doesn't have an accomplice.
Correct.
If he has a guy waiting in a car, and, you know, again, it could have been a taxi, could have been something like that. But if it is, mm-hmm. then you have someone to say, hey, yeah, just hop in this back seat. Wait, does this smell like chloroform to you?
Exactly.
So, I don't know. But I'm with you. It is interesting. And I do think that probably a light bulb went off in his head and he was like, ah, this is more my speed. This is the comfort zone.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't know. It just
also just in terms of escalation, like the ruses are getting more elaborate. The crimes are getting more intense. Like,
but he did this on a dime. He didn't yeah. go there intending to take Grace. He didn't know there was a Grace.
Right.
She just happened to get home from play. If she had stayed at her friend's house
another hour, maybe even.
Perhaps he would have left sooner because he would have taken them. Now, granted, would her brother be dead? Maybe. But it's just all of these little decisions and these little choices and coincidence, or they all had consequences. And yeah. these consequences were deadly.
Ugh.
But he went for kids, and so the 18-year-old really doesn't make sense to me.
No.
So I don't know.
Other than, all I have is that it sounds like historically he's been more interested in boys or men.
Yes.
And that is literally it.
We're going to talk about that in part three.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Bring that up. Remind me.
Okay.
Write that down. But meanwhile, so he's, you know, in and out of the hospital. He'd been to the hospital a few times, Albert Fish.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's talking like the letters. He's getting arrested for the letters. Like, I can't imagine what it was that he wrote in those letters that got him arrested, but he did.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there, and I'm sure he was a model patient, you know, answered their questions, whatever. How honest he was, I don't know. But they knew something was up with him, but it wasn't like yeah. they had the authority to keep him there. And also, if they're anything like they are today, then they are grossly understaffed. If not, if they exist at all. I mean, our mental, right. our psychiatric facilities are few and far between now. But had they had that, they didn't know what we know now. He probably could have outsmarted them because he would have known what it was that they were looking to figure out. He's been assessed before. He knows what to say.
Right. And he knows the questions.
Yeah, it's pretty easy not to be distracted when there's nothing there distracting you because yep. there are no children. So I think it was a mix of all of those things. I don't think we can point to one to say, how the hell did they let him out of that hospital?
Right.
There's a lot. But regardless, he's doing his own thing. And meanwhile, the investigators and the family and everyone else trying to pick up the pieces and figure out what happened. And they keep going down these dead ends. So in September of 1930, 2 years since she's been missing, another tip came in.
Okay.
This time from a woman who claimed the kidnapper was her estranged husband.
Ooh.
Charles Pope, oh. who was 68 years old and worked as a janitor.
Okay.
She contacted Detective King, the lead investigator, and said, you need to look into him. I think he's your guy. And she told the following story. She and her husband did not have a happy marriage, and they were not living together. They seemingly didn't speak much. She received a telegram from him requesting they meet, and it happened to be the same day that Grace was kidnapped. Mm-hmm. When she arrived at this meeting place, he was with a girl who looked to be about 10. She wore a white dress. She looked kind of scared. Her husband asked if she could watch the girl for a few days while he was out of town. She said no.
Okay.
Probably along the lines of like, we don't even speak anymore. I will not watch this random child for you.
Right.
And not able to get her to agree to watch after this little girl, he left with the little girl. She said the look the girl gave her was one she'd never forget. He left with the kid. She never saw her again. And then the news of Grace Budd's disappearance hit the papers.
Wow.
And she thought, okay, this could be related. And Detective King, he's like, okay. Well, Grace went missing in 1928. Why did you wait until 1930
to bring it up?
To come forward with this theory. And she said she forgot. And she didn't read much about Grace anymore. And when she did, she was like, oh, I got to tell someone about that. So she did.
Wow, what a giver.
They tracked Charles Pope down. He wasn't far. And interviews with him revealed he was genuinely shocked to be accused of such a horrific crime. And by his wife, no less.
Yeah.
His wife went to the Budd family. So she traveled to the Budd's home, visited with them, and convinced Delia Budd that her husband was the kidnapper.
Girl.
This woman described Grace to Delia, and they talked about Grace and showed a photo of her, and she said, yeah, that's the girl I saw. Did she have this length hair? And Delia's like, yes, she did. That's my girl. She's like, yeah, I saw her. I saw her with my estranged husband.
And then I did nothing for 2 years. Love you, Lilas, XOXO Hags.
In a lineup, you guessed it, Delia Budd identified him as Frank Howard because she had been told all about him by his estranged wife.
And at this point, who isn't fucking Frank Howard?
To her, exactly. This is like the third or maybe even fourth person Delia Budd has identified.
Right. And that's not, you know, this isn't me saying it's purposeful, but...
But it's saying at this point, can we just let this poor woman sit this one out?
Right. She is clearly not a credible witness. And also she is in so much pain and grief that she can be convinced that any man is the man who took her daughter.
And she will so strongly push for that and agree with that and claim that, like, she believes it. It's not that she's not faking it. I don't think.
Right.
I think her nerves are shot. I think she's grieving. I think her brain is fried from the grief, the panic, the stress, the sleepless nights, the search, the investigation, getting your hopes up and down and up and down. I think all of that is like, it's him.
And equally as much conviction as hope, I can imagine. Like, please let this one just be the one. Like, let it be done.
And then this woman approaches her to her home and says, I just know he did it. I know my husband. There's something wrong with him. I saw him the day your daughter was taken. This girl looked just like her. And then she was gone.
Ugh.
Charles Pope was arrested for the kidnapping of Grace Budd shortly after. He matched the description. He did kind of look like him in that he was an older gentleman, but he was 68.
Yeah.
And Albert Fish was like early 50s at this point.
Right.
So there's 15 years between them, but okay. Again, the evil. I think it ages you. But
yeah,
he did kind of match the description. There's a witness, his wife, saying that she saw her husband and Grace together, and now Delia Budd has identified him.
Yeah, that's a stellar case if you bring it to court.
So it wasn't looking good for Charles Pope. Then they search his garage, and that revealed that he had locks of child's brown hair in a box.
Oh.
They also found kids' toys and trinkets, and white stockings that looked a lot like the ones Grace wore the day she disappeared.
Oh, God.
What are your thoughts on Charles Pope?
I'm thinking he did something. Or he had a kid and he was, I don't know, grieved early. But I don't think that that's the case.
Well, it turns out Charles Pope, though he didn't have much to his name, was due an inheritance. And his greedy wife wanted the money.
That's it.
But they were estranged. And he didn't want to give her anything. She had him committed to a hospital for treatment, at which time they deemed him completely fine. Yeah. A friendly older gentleman who wasn't a harm to himself or others. So that didn't work. So then she accused him of being the kidnapper of Grace Budd.
Yep.
Because her plot to get his money when he was impatient didn't work because there was no reason for him to be impatient. She said, well, maybe I'll do this. The lock of hair found in his garage belonged to one of his kids from their first haircut.
Yep, thought so.
The clothes were clothes that had belonged to his kids, and he was going to pass them down to his grandkids. But the damage was done.
Right.
They put him on trial. The only one who should be put on trial is that greedy wench who tried to ruin a man's life for money.
Yeah, that's disgusting.
Oh, and go ahead.
Sorry, and also to go to someone's fucking house to convince them that their child is dead and that this man did it.
Not even dead, but just he took her and I never saw her again. This was two years ago. So what do you think happened?
And not for nothing.
And there's hair. And I think Grace might have had like a similar color hair, but it was like very thin childlike hair. So it wasn't. It was probably from his child's first haircut. He was being honest.
Right. And
this was all confirmed.
There are all of these things that he owns that in combination with other things do seem suspicious. But anybody who's a parent, I think, can understand where that is. Like, I have a box of baby clothes at my parents' house.
But it's creepy. Even you sitting here, not familiar with this case, really, you were like, there's something up with this guy. What is going on? And it's just because I told it a certain way. And I did that intentionally because you had the exact reaction I would have and so many other people would have, would be like, okay, he was seen with a girl. He looks a hell of a lot like the guy. We don't really know what's going on. He's got hair and kids' clothes, and they found like a white stocking that looked a lot like Grace's potentially, so that could have been it, when in reality those were his kids' clothes. Those stockings were common. A lot of the kids went to church. That's what they wore.
Yeah,
if not to his grandkids, he was donating them to charity. Like, he kept things around,
and you're allowed to be fucking sentimental. Like, that is a right in my book.
Even
like,
if he wanted to buy every single doll and Barbie that I don't know if Barbies existed, but every single doll out there and cut the heads off of them and have a box of doll heads, creepy as fuck, no doubt, but perfectly legal. I wouldn't do it, but who am I to say? Who am I to say in your own home this is what you cannot do?
Right. And I think, you know, granted that this was one of the first true crime cases that really got me interested as a whole of like, this is a new level of fuckery. It's hard because I hear things like that and certain boxes get checked and you go, I don't know.
And it's not wrong that they're checked, but then it's like, okay, that's enough to bring up some suspicion, but you cannot convict a man.
Oh, hell no.
On this. And that's what happened. And to say that Albert Fish was the only one of his kind that existed back then, no.
No.
Nope. He was a monster. There were other monsters. We probably don't know their names.
Yeah.
But they're out there.
Monsters that were better at not getting caught.
They're out there today. They do it in different ways. It's probably not the ads in the paper. It's searching on your open Instagram page, your open Facebook page, or creeping on your Twitter or whatever it is. That's why I really don't do the social media thing. A big part of it really is doing these cases. And I'm like, hell no.
No.
But this did exist, and it doesn't seem too great for him, I'll be honest. But how quickly it was also dismissed. Well, he's a dad. He's a grandfather.
Right.
Of course he's going to have those things in his home. He wants to be able to pass that down. He's a family-loving man. His wife's a word I won't say.
Yeah.
And if anyone deserved to be on trial, it should have been her for interfering with an investigation and false reports to law enforcement and all of these things. And she traveled. I mean, how could you live with yourself? You travel to a grieving family's home, sit with the mother, probably hold her hands and say, I saw your daughter. And Delia Budd is like, you saw my daughter.
Because it's all she has to hold on to. She's going to white knuckle that.
It's the only lead. It's the only thing. Her daughter disappeared. And she watched her go. And she never saw her again. And then there's this seemingly angelic figure that comes to you and says, oh my God, I saw her 2 years ago. I know it was him. Let's get him together.
Yeah.
And Delia's like,
yeah, let's get him together.
What does he look like? I'm going to identify him.
Yeah.
And he did not look like Albert Fish, where right. It wasn't like, oh, that looks nothing like him. It can't be. No.
They looked enough alike.
They looked enough alike, and I'm sure it's sleep deprivation and nerves and grief and God knows what else. And oh, mind you, the depression.
Yeah.
And all of that.
Doubt now of 2 years. You know, we talked about knowing that a 10-year-old wouldn't look the exact same 2 years later. The older guy probably wouldn't either.
Well, think about this, maybe. I mean,
like, if I'm her, you know?
Let's say you go out to eat and you have a waitress. She introduces herself, whatever. What can I get you? Can I get you drinks? Can I get you food? Do we need a dessert menu over here? Mm-hmm. They drop off the bill and the dad's like, what's the damage? You know, like,
yeah.
Typical, right? Say 2 years from then, you're asked to give a physical description
of this waitress.
You spent a few hours with her, maybe.
Yeah.
Had some conversation. Maybe she told you where else she works or when she started working here. You heard about the specials, even though you were just being nice and you really didn't care. You looked up the menu beforehand and you knew what you were getting if you're anything like me.
Same.
But you heard them and you were kind and you said, no, I think I'm going to go with this. You knew damn well you weren't going to get it, but you know, you heard her out. She's got to say what she's got to say. Yeah. And you respect that. You go, girl. But if you had to give a description of this girl, even 2 weeks later.
Right.
I think she was a brunette. Now, granted, the permanence of that situation wasn't the same. She didn't walk away with your child. But I'm saying, describing what somebody looks like and how similar people appeared and dressed with like facial hair was, there were certain marks of that. A lot of people had mustaches. You see less of them today.
Yep.
More people had probably like those long beards. I don't know. The clothing was a sign of the times versus now we have like a million different options. There weren't a whole lot of them then.
Right.
He wore a decent suit. It wasn't the most well-fitting. It wasn't super expensive, but it was a suit.
Right.
He was a thin, frail, middle-aged man with a gray mustache. He probably looked a whole hell of a lot like other people.
Yeah.
And if I were to give the description of the waitress, it probably could have passed for like half the town.
Yeah, of course.
So when you apply that to this, it's like, well, Delia, yeah, probably believed it. Probably believed all of it.
Yeah.
So, ultimately, they did put him on trial. But get this. At the same time Charles Pope goes on trial, they found Albert Courthill.
What?
Do you remember the other guy? The con man guy? So they had their two suspects and they were like, well, we kind of thought it was both of them.
Yeah.
And we couldn't find Albert Courthill and now Charles Pope looked really good. And then like part the way through is like they figured out what his wife was doing and everything. Ultimately, nobody was convicted of anything. Thank God. But these two men were accused, and Albert Courthill was con artist. Maybe he got time for something else, but their names were permanently sullied. They almost had like this black mark around their names. Like it was, you were a suspected child murderer.
Yeah.
And once you're accused,
that's good as convicted in a lot of ways.
That can be pretty damning. And what if people only heard all the evidence, quote unquote, evidence against you, but never heard the update?
Yeah.
Right? Because the updates don't always make the news. The story's already sold. The buy-in from the reader happened when you said, we have all of this evidence and here's the evidence we have against the guy. But it's rarely, the readers rarely are like, well, I want to hear all the ways he was acquitted.
Right.
It's not as juicy. We're on to the next one. He's already convicted in my mind.
Not for nothing, but science has shown that humans are significantly less likely to remember updates to big things like that, especially if it elicits a major emotion, and that we don't want that. I mean,
no, because it's juicier that way. And mm-hmm. in fear-mongering and panic and all of that, we want to hold on to that. I mean, and that is part of, probably part of human nature now. I don't know if it always was, but I certainly think it is to a degree. And, you know, Charles Pope was 68 and probably lived the rest of his life with people looking over their shoulder at him because his wife was greedy and wanted money he wasn't willing to give her because she probably was a bitch.
Well, they were estranged.
For a reason.
Yep.
And she went to, like, the ends of the earth. And by that, I mean
Brooklyn. Well, it's the Depression, and she traveled to find a family.
To
give them
manipulate.
Yeah.
Regardless, Charles Pope is yet another indirect victim of Albert Fish. His victim count and the reach of his evil might be the most expansive I've covered.
Ugh.
But back to Albert. Albert Fish, I should say.
Yeah, I was...
Fish was again arrested for these naughty, vile letters, some of which wouldn't be read in court. They actually refused to read them in court because to read them would defile the court.
Wow.
That's how bad they were.
And they say some shit in court.
Well, and back then it was a lot more reserved. They wouldn't, but to read them out loud would defile the court and the court record. So they said nope.
And they said, we won't take a human dirt on this court.
No. But I'm going to tell you about a carrot in a second.
Oh.
Because, during this, they look under, like, he got arrested for this, whatever. So they're, like, looking in his house. I don't exactly know why. Maybe for more letters. I think they were looking for all the other ones that he was about to sell and or send. And he did have a stack of, like, unsent letters just, like, waiting for more unsuspecting victims. I know.
He's, like, the inspiration struck. And I am just, like, overflowing with this nasty vileness. And I just... gotta get that on the page while I have my muse.
I just imagine him by candlelight, like, writing all of this gross-ass stuff. He's vile. He just is. But they looked under his bed, and that's where some of the letters were hidden, just waiting to be stamped and sent. But they also found decaying food, like carrots and a hot dog. And they were like, what's up with the carrots, bud? And he's like, oh, I put them up my ass, okay? I'm paraphrasing. He's
sorry,
like, those are my butt plug carrots.
It's like, I like the leafy greens because I can pull them out.
Eat your vegetables, you know what I mean? But he literally, seriously, had old, moldy, decaying, poop-soaked... food under his bed that he used to pleasure himself, and the cop found it and was like, what is this? Because they didn't, I'm sure they put it together, but I think they were like, like 2 + 2 wasn't equaling 4, like they could not compute what they found. And he was like, I put those in my anus.
That 2 + 2 does equal 4. You know, I hate to say it like this, but that is probably the most anyone's enjoyed a carrot. But
probably.
But
you know, odd.
If, sure, that's a word.
It's
so nice compared to what I'd use. Wow.
If you didn't know, now you know. Detective King did something in this investigation, and I mean investigation of Grace Budd's murder, not of the stanky carrot. But
yeah, that case is solved.
Yes.
Regrettably.
He did something that was almost unheard of at the time, but we see it occasionally now. He plied different news outlets with different false details of happened. So they'd write a story with this detail, and this one would write a story with this detail. And it wasn't necessarily to, like, find geographically where he might have been.
Right.
Like, to say which story might have popped up or whatever. But it allowed him to rule out some of the fake letters that were coming in.
Right.
Because with a new quote unquote detail coming out, letters would start pouring in referring to that detail as truth.
Right.
And so he's like, I know you're not it. You're not it. You're not it. Because, you know, they just wanted
the attention.
They wanted the attention, notoriety, whatever it was. I don't know why they do things like that, but to get a rise, regardless, he was able to rule them out, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's smart detective work.
There were specific details of the case that he kept close to the vest. Maybe pun intended. Hmm. And these details would be telltale signs that the writer was the killer if they knew them.
Right.
So, you know, he let all these false ones out, but he kept very specific details that were true to him. So he's like always on the lookout for those details, because right. if those were to come up,
he knows he didn't give those out.
Correct. And that's exactly what happened.
Ooh.
And that, no, I'm just kidding. I'm not going to leave
you
there.
Oh my gosh.
We are going to get into it. If I ended it here, we'd have like several more parts, but.
What a giver.
I had to bring a little bit of levity because what we're about to get into is a very horrific letter.
All right.
So before we get into this, this is a heads up that we are going into the Grace Budd letter. I will not be reading all of it for you, and really, I still do not recommend that you do. I will summarize it like I did with the Billy Gaffney letter because there are important details that shouldn't be lost in understanding this case. But I'm not taunting you to go read it. And I promise you will sleep better tonight and every night after if you don't. I read all the letters as much as I could find that was written by him, and I am not better for it.
Okay.
I don't recommend. So we're fast forwarding. It is now 6 years since she has disappeared.
Oh my gosh.
A letter arrived at the Budd home. They had moved and their new address was listed in the paper.
Ugh.
As it was back then. Albert Fish saw it. He saw that the Budd family moved and decided to write them a letter.
Oh, congrats on the new home. Also, took your kid.
Different times putting all that information out there, but again, we do it willingly today with thousands of people online. So look how far we've come. This letter arrived November of 1934. And when it did, Mrs. Budd handed it over to her son, Edward, because she couldn't read. So this letter came in addressed to her, but she couldn't read it. So she gave it to her son to read it to her. I will give you the beginning of the letter, but I will not read all of it. It says this. My dear Mrs. Budd, in 1894, a friend of mine shipped as a deckhand on the steamer Tacoma, Captain John Davis. They sailed from San Francisco for Hong Kong, China. On arriving there, he and two others went ashore and got drunk. When they returned, the boat was gone. At that time, there was famine in China. Meat of any kind was from $1 to $3 a pound. So great was the suffering among the very poor that all children under 12 were sold for food in order to keep them from starving. End quote. It continues that this so-called friend, which, mind you, if it helps at all, I believe that most of this is bullshit. This friend engaged in eating children, as they had to survive, he says. But when he did finally manage to return to the States, he had a taste for the flesh of children that couldn't be tempered. He goes on to say that this friend, once home in the U.S., kidnapped, murdered, and ate children, and told Albert Fish all about how good they taste. Which sparked Albert Fish's interest in this. The letter continues. On Saturday, June the 3rd, 1928, I called on you at 406 West 15th Street, brought you pot, cheese, and strawberries. We had lunch. Grace sat in my lap and kissed me. I made up my mind to eat her. On the pretense of taking her to a party, you said yes, she could go. I took her to an empty house in Westchester I'd already picked out. When we got there, I told her to remain outside. She picked wildflowers.
Oh.
To continue summarizing, he continues to describe what he did next. He says that he undressed himself, called out to her from the window that it was time to come in. So she came in and entered the room that he was in, and he was naked and she was scared. She tried to run away. She said that she was going to tell her mama. She fought to free herself from him, but he was stronger. He strangled her and knelt on her chest, ultimately killing her. He then detailed how he dismembered her, decapitated her, and drank her blood, and ate her body over the course of 9 days. He concluded the letter by letting Mrs. Budd know that Grace died a virgin, admitting he didn't sexually assault her. The Grace Budd letter, again, you know the details that you need to now.
Mm-hmm.
Don't read it. Edward Budd was the one to read this letter, addressed to his mother, but he was the one that opened it, and he read it in its entirety. Delia Budd saw his face and asked what the letter said. I mean, he'd need to tell her she couldn't read it herself, and thank God, I've never been grateful for illiteracy.
Yeah.
But I am so grateful that she couldn't read that. Instead, he didn't answer her. He ran to the police department and reported it.
Good.
Detective King knew immediately that this was their guy.
Yeah.
The details about the strawberries and the pot cheese, that was never released.
Okay.
So that was one of the details that he kept to himself, saying if that ever came up, we know that we've got him. Only the killer knew that. Only the killer wrote about it. After 6 years, he finally had a good lead, a lead worth following.
Right.
The letter had an emblem and the acronym NYPCBA was written in it,
mm-hmm.
which stood for New York Private Chauffeurs Benevolent Association. Don't ask me to say that again.
Okay.
Detective King went there and asked if they had any employees or members by the name of Frank Howard. They didn't. And then Detective William King looked at the signatures of every single member of the association to try wow. matching it to the letter.
Wow.
Because he had the letter. So he's like, I gotta see. I gotta know. Okay, so Frank Howard, no, but he's got some tie to this place. He right. wrote it on their stationery, basically.
Yes.
So it's got to be something, right? There were something like 350 to 400 members. He went through all of it, and there was no match.
Wow.
Then a janitor approached him and said, listen, I'm not sure if this is important, but I took some stationery from here.
Mm-hmm.
And brought it back to my rooming house where I was staying. I didn't really get a chance to use all of it, so I just left it in the room.
Okay.
It's possible that it's still at the rooming house, and it's possible that they forgot to get rid of it or chose not to get rid of it and just left it in the room, so maybe the tenant that had the room after me
used it,
but that's one opportunity. So King jumped on this shit and right. marched his ass to the rooming house and spoke with the landlady who ran the place.
Yes, King. Woo. Get it?
Detective King. I know. He's on some King shit, I'm telling you.
Yes.
He asked if there was currently or ever in the past a tenant named Frank Howard. She said no, but she did tell him who rented the room after the janitor, and that was none other than Albert Fish.
Okay.
She said, unfortunately, he's recently moved out, so I don't know where he is now, but apparently before he did move out, he asked her to let him know when a piece of mail arrived because his son was going to be mailing him a check.
Oh.
I think his son was just sending him money, like, to help him or whatever. Right. He didn't live locally anymore. He was mailing it, and that was his mailing address, so that's where the son was going to send it. So he's like, can you let me know when this letter is received? I'm gonna come pick it up because it's a check.
Okay.
And she, at the time, not knowing anything, was like, yeah, sure, I'll let you know. King knew he had him.
Yeah.
He just knew it. He just had to wait for that check to come in. I'm not exactly sure how long it did take, but sure enough, it showed. On December 13th, that same landlady reached out to Detective King to let him know that the check's here. What do you want me to do?
Right.
He said, okay, I'm going to call, like, you need to call him. Try to stall him for a little bit because I'm going to be right there. She set Albert up with some tea.
Okay.
Because he went to go get the check. He wants his money. So she's like, I just got to go find it. I'm going to have you sit here, sip on some tea. Kind of like in a room off to the side.
Yeah.
So that he could, like, I mean, really be alone and have space so that there was a room for the detective to get him in.
Right.
So he's just chilling, drinking his tea. The lady's like, probably sweating bullets. I cannot imagine what it's like to know that there's a child killer like in the room next to you and you're like, doo-doo-doo, just trying to keep you here. Don't hurt me, please.
Right.
But finally, Detective King arrived. He entered the rooming house. He went to the doorway of the room that Albert Fish was sitting in, and sure enough, he was sitting there drinking tea. Fish nodded to the detective. They finally got him. And that is where I will leave you in part two, and we will wrap up this whole thing in part three next week.
Wow. Wow, 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 wow. Wow.
Or, wow.
Wow. Yikes. Amazing. Awful. Great job. Terrible case.
Horrible case.
Cannot wait to see him get his ass.
Oh, yeah. One of the most horrific, horrible, terrible cases. Again, reading the letters, I'm going to keep bringing it up, but I'm not bringing that up to taunt you. I'm bringing it up to say don't do it.
Right. No, I started crying at the summary.
Yes.
So
I noticed that. We kept it moving.
Will not be reading the details.
No.
No.
Would highly encourage you not to do so. We're going to talk next episode. First of all, we're going to talk about getting him. We're going to talk about court theories, all different things. We're going to talk a lot about his kids because I kind of wanted it to be set up that we didn't talk about the kids in the beginning because I wanted their input to sort of be reflective on their childhood and sort of talk about it in the context of what they knew, because ultimately they find out.
Ugh.
And they're recalling their childhood through the lens of knowing essentially what we all know right now.
Right.
So I kind of wanted to save that so that we're kind of all looking at it the same way.
Right.
So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about different theories as to did he or didn't he have an accomplice.
Okay.
I think it could go either way. We're going to talk about mental health. And I mean, his mental health in terms of was he insane? And we're going to wrap it up with him getting the chair. So if you need anything to hold on to, he gets lit.
Him and Bundy are similar that way.
Yes. So I appreciate if you made it through that, please practice some self-care.
Oh, my good God.
I really appreciate you doing it because I know that these aren't easy things to talk about, but they really are important. And if we think that there aren't people like Albert Fish out there today, we are sadly mistaken.
And the other piece of it, too, is like these kids deserve that recognition, right? Like for a long time, we repeated almost ad nauseum, like if they can go through it, we can talk about it. But truly, this was a 10-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
If 10 before that, and it was a 8 year old. And 4 year olds can go through all this shit, we can bear to hear about it.
And ultimately, we're going to talk about what I believe to be a relatively accurate victim count.
Ugh, shit.
So thank you for sticking around. We really appreciate it. If you liked what you heard, we definitely think you should rate us 5 stars. Maybe leave us a review. If you want to pop on like Apple and Spotify, I'm just saying,
girl,
I'm not you, girl. I don't know. But really just thank you guys for being here. It makes us want to continue doing this. This was hours and hours and hours.
Yes.
Of work. And again, I wasn't lying when I said last episode that I cried and I was nauseous, and I read the Grace Bud letter before dinner and I didn't eat again till the next day.
I don't doubt it.
So there, you know, we sit with these cases probably longer than you think, and it feels good to get it out. I'm looking forward to next week to concluding this and having you hear all of it, because I really do want to hear all your feedback. I'm also ready to put this case to bed.
Yes.
And move on to something else. But there's still so much more, so many more details to come forward. There's a lot that we don't know yet. We actually hear a lot in Albert Fish's words what happened.
Okay.
So we're kind of getting what they were able to piece together. We're going to find out, and what he would say really happened.
I'm very curious to hear what he says happened versus what we have accounts of.
Yes. And I mean, they differ. There's more details. We find out what happened from the moment Grace Bud left her home.
Wow.
So stay tuned for that. We will see you next week.
Yes. If you wanted to practice some of that self-care, if you wanted to look at some resources that we have linked or some reprieves, some silly, goofy memes, we would heavily recommend you do that. You can also see the people, the places, and the things that we are talking about up on Instagram. So you would just open up Instagram either in your app or on Instagram.am, and you can type in that little search bubble at About Time for True Crime Pod with periods in between every word. So that is ABOUT period TIME period FOR period TRUE period CRIME period POD, because podcast was way too damn long. And if you wanted to send us something a little bit longer, maybe a personal take on the case, something that's happened, something you think that's interesting or relevant, as long as it is appropriate and not creepy, we will respond. You could do that to our email, but Allie, where would they email that?
If you wanted to send us an email or send us some pod pets, we love pod pets, just send them.
Yeah.
If you wanted to do that, you could do that to our email, which is abouttime4tc@gmail.com. So that's abouttime4tc@gmail.com. We love you and we love to see you. Woof.
Woof. Seriously, the ATFDC fam is not the same without you. So please go take care of that in the next week. If you do that so that we can see you next time, I'll look at my watch, because that was
About Time for True Crime.
Bye. What the hell, dude?
I know. I know.
I want to vomit.